broadcasting in English. You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. I'm Daniela Lazarová. Coming up in today's show, a fresh edition of Czech books in which David Vaughan will feature an English Renaissance poet in Prague. This being Saturday, we'll be going places. Christian Falvey will invite you to a trip to Kostelec nad Černými lesy, a town bearing the poetic name The Fort Over the Black Forests. And then you can hear another in Radio Prague's mini-series from the archives. All that coming your way over the next half hour, and first we turn to literature. In Czech books this week, we find out about the life and times of an English-born Renaissance poet who spent nearly all her life in Prague, and in her time was more celebrated than Shakespeare. David Vaughan has been exploring the life and work of Westonia.
We've talked in past editions of Czech books about the remarkable Elizabeth Jane Weston, known in her time as the Virgo Angla, the English maiden at the court of Rudolf II. At the turn of the 16th and 17th centuries, she was considered one of Europe's great poets. Here is an extract from a poem that Elizabeth Jane dedicated to the Flemish composer Philippe de Mont, who at the time was living out his last years in Prague. She wrote the poem in Latin, so here it is in translation.
What is left to say? Music keeps us sound, dispels sickness, confirms friendships. It leads our senses to an obedient spirit and draws that same spirit to the heavens in a resounding voice. Yet do not foolishly consider that to be harmony, which alas becomes pernicious in its allurement. But what Phoebus has blessed you with, praiseworthy Philip, is serious or comes only by the gift of the gods. It snatches our emotions from the ground and exalts them to Olympus and can call our spirits away from vice. So rejoice in these gifts and fare you well, great Philip, that you may be sung throughout the whole world.
Elizabeth Jane Weston has been all but forgotten, and this inspired me to do some more research, talking to scholars in both the Czech Republic and Britain, and visiting some of the places in both countries associated with the poet. The outcome is A Poet in Bohemia, a radio documentary to be broadcast by BBC Radio 3 on October the 16th. One of the people I met in the course of my research was Professor Susan Basnett from the University of Warwick, who is probably the world's foremost scholar on Westonia's life and work. In today's Czech books, I talk to Susan Basnett about the poet.
I have been working with Elizabeth Weston, with Westonia, for over 20 years. I have this enormous, I suppose you'd call it, affinity with Westonia. She and I both grew up in different countries. We spoke different languages. We both write poetry. We diverge on a number of things, but I have felt myself very, very strongly drawn to working on her. And I'm at the present writing a book about her life. I first encountered Westonia in Prague in the early 1980s, thanks to very distinguished Czech professor Zdeněk Štrbený. I was taken to see the grave of an English woman, an English poet, who, a contemporary of Shakespeare, was infinitely better known than Shakespeare, was in touch with all the great intellectuals and luminaries of Europe, while Shakespeare was pretty much, I suppose, a local hack. And yet Shakespeare's reputation has risen and risen and become global, and Westonia's reputation has receded to the point where, after the middle of the 18th century, nobody read her and very, very few people had even heard of her.
This happens quite often. This happened all through literary history, and sometimes writers are deservedly forgotten. Is that not the case with Elizabeth Weston?
She isn't deservedly forgotten, in my view, but her poetry is very much of its time. She wrote a series of praise poems to friends and distinguished people. She played around with various forms of Latin verse, and none of that became really fashionable once we had Romanticism, because what she doesn't do is write passionate personal poetry. And so once the vogue for passionate personal poetry or passionate nature poetry came in, people like Westonia, who were writing in very contained forms, albeit using those forms in highly innovative and original ways, simply weren't read anymore.
And there is also the factor that she was writing in Latin.
She was writing in Latin in an age when numerous people wrote in Latin. I mean, basically all intellectuals would not only write in Latin, but speak in Latin. I mean, we tend to forget that Elizabeth I was entirely capable of doing extemporary speeches in Latin and prided herself on doing so. And she was also translating from the Latin right up to within weeks of her death. So actually, knowing Latin, writing in Latin, again, it's something of its time, but by the age of personal expression and romanticism and the rise of popularity of national literatures, poets were principally admired for what they could do in their own language, not for what they could do in a classical language.
And you have mentioned Shakespeare, but Elizabeth Jane Weston's world is, it's worlds away from Shakespeare's, isn't it?
Shakespeare's world was one of travelling players. It was a world very based in urban English society. Elizabeth's was a very different world in that she mixed with high-level intellectuals who crossed the boundary, and I think this is very important for her. She was not just a writer of poetry. She was also someone very into new science, astronomy, new alchemy. And we have to remember that this is an age when the line between magic and mathematics is so thin that it virtually doesn't exist. So Elizabeth was caught up in that world of what I suppose, looking back, we'd call alternative science, but in fact was the kind of science that Isaac Newton, not long afterwards, would also be practicing.
And that's also very much a reflection of Rudolfine Prague at the time, isn't it? It was such an interesting place, a melting pot for so many scientists, alchemists, astrologers, astronomers, who were all gathered and rotating around in the Rudolfine court.
Yes, it's very much a case of what Rudolf II viewed as important, his musicians, his painters, his scientists, and so on. But I think we tend to forget, when we talk about Leonardo da Vinci being Renaissance man, that having an interest in literature, music, fine art, mathematics, philosophy, alchemy, physics, you name it, was very much part of being an intellectual in the Renaissance generally.
Here are a few lines from one of several poems that Westonia wrote in honour of the Emperor Rudolf.
May Caesar's empire, which establishes rewards for the muses, flourish, and may Caesar's court long thrive. May the anger of the Turk be smashed, and the name of tyrant perish. Henceforth, may your people worship you. May the land be fertile. May the contagions of pestilence flee. And may temples, theatres and schools all rise together.
Little is known about Elizabeth Jane Weston's roots. Only in the last few decades has research revealed that she was born in the Oxfordshire market town of Chipping Norton, probably in 1581. Her father appears to have been a scholar. Parish records describe him as a clerk. And her mother came from a wealthy local farming family. Elizabeth Jane was still a babe in arms when her father died, and not long afterwards her mother remarried. The man she married was the alchemist Edward Kelly, who was employed, thanks to his supposed ability to communicate with spirits, by none other than the greatest philosopher and mathematician of Elizabethan England, Dr. John Dee. A year later, in September 1583, the entire Kelly and Dee families, presumably including Elizabeth Jane and her brother John Francis, headed off from London, first to Poland and then to Prague. Elizabeth Jane found herself growing up and ultimately spending the rest of her life in Bohemia. While John Dee eventually returned to London, Edward Kelly gradually gained considerable favour at the court of the Emperor Rudolf, and was even knighted. He made sure that both John Francis and Elizabeth Jane were given the best tutors available. At the time it was rare, but not unheard of for a girl to have such a good education.
I think there are two issues, really. One is the actual history of women's education in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance is quite cloudy. A lot has come to light in the last 30 years. Before that, it was generally assumed that only boys were educated and girls were not, and we now know that's nonsense. One of the most interesting cases I can think of is Lucretia Borgia. We all think of her as a poisoner, an adulteress, or whatever. In fact, she was really a very erudite, very learned woman who wrote a little bit of verse herself, but also cultivated around her some very, very high-level poets, and, of course, conversed in Latin. And we tend to forget all that. We tend to forget the high level of women's education at the court of Isabella and Ferdinand of Spain, which is why Mary Tudor and ultimately Elizabeth were so well educated. And Latin was the absolute cornerstone, because Latin was regarded as the supreme language, the sublime language. If you could compose good verse in Latin, this was a demonstration not just of your intellect and of your status, but also really in a sense of your innate poetic ability. And so there's a whole number of women who tried their hand at this.
Westonia's education put her in good stead when her stepfather Edward Kelly fell out of grace with the imperial court. He was imprisoned and the family's properties confiscated. After his death, under circumstances that are far from clear, Elizabeth Jane, still in her teens, fought determinedly to win back the family's fortunes. The weapon she used was poetry. She addressed hundreds of influential figures around the Emperor Rudolf, writing exquisitely crafted Latin poems, begging them for support and patronage. And remarkably, she succeeded. Her poetry was so impressive that she very soon became a celebrity in literary circles across Europe. She went on to publish two sizable volumes of poetry and correspondence, in the meantime getting married, in 1603, to imperial lawyer Johannes Leo. Over the next 9 years, they had 7 children, only 3 of whom survived infancy.
I think what comes across from her poetry, from her letters, from what we know about her, is that she was a person clearly with a great deal of energy. She fought passionately for what she saw as her rights and her family's rights. And that sense of grievance, injustice, of someone battling to right a wrong, is very, very strongly there. She did bear grudges. You can see that in some of her poems. There's also the edition in the British Library where there's a handwritten note, which I like to think she wrote, which basically complains bitterly about what her editors have done to her. So I think she was a fairly strong-minded person. She's also obviously a very kind person.
And what of her poetry itself?
Her poetry is, I think, first of all, very learned. That's important to stress. It's not personal in the sense that we understand personal poetry today. It's very scholarly. She demonstrates in her poems what she's read. So even where she's writing about natural events, there was a terrible flood in Prague that she wrote about. She writes about gardens. She writes religious poems about, you know, the birth of Christ. She writes about events. But always there's this extraordinary learning, so that when you read her work, what you can see, or what her contemporaries would have seen, was a modern woman using classical scholarship and classical conventions in new and exciting ways.
No one who has not been touched by it can speak of the force and power of insatiable death. Indeed, I would have thought it raged through our bodies only and could not wound the spirit with its darts. But the reality teaches me far otherwise and makes me speak as one who has been wounded and is experienced.
Those were a few lines from a poem Elizabeth Jane Weston wrote on her mother's death in 1606. She herself had only another 6 years to live. She died on November the 23rd, 1612, at the age of just over 30. At the time, she was probably the best-known English writer on mainland Europe. Gradually, she is once again being remembered, even if most of us can only enjoy her work through translations.
David Vaughan will be back next week with a fresh edition of Czech Books. Now, this being Saturday, it's time to go places, and we're now offering you another chance to go on a trip to the Fort Above the Black Forests, one of the main centres of forestry in the Czech Republic and an often overlooked pearl of Bohemian cultural heritage. Christian Falvey gives us his impression of the town.
Past villages that would translate as Scrawnyville and Goat Eaters, which is not far from the town of Horse Eaters, and through the Valley of the Devil's Trenches is Kostelec nad Černými lesy, or the Fort Above the Black Forests. Though there is little sign of malnutrition in Vizhlovka or gnawed bones and discarded horns in Kozojedy, the town of Kostelec nad Černými lesy does indeed rise out of a depth of coniferous forest on the road from Prague to Kutná Hora. Here's Pavel Karnet from the University of Forestry Enterprise.
Several centuries ago, this area was surrounded by deep forests. There was a dark tree species composition, beech, it is Fagus silvatica, spruce, Picea abies, and Abies alba, fir in English. Of course, tree species composition was changed, but the name is still Kostelec nad Černými lesy.
Both the past and present history of Kostelec is very much linked to the deep woods around the town. They gave rise to a lumbering industry, for one thing, which led to lumbering regulation, and in turn to the University of Forestry Enterprise and a research institute. In addition to the university itself, the town of only 3,600 people also has a 30-hectare arboretum, and a strong forestry industry is also an important part of its life. As I wandered around the town hall, I met Karel Michalík, an importer of seeds and saplings, and the chairman of the local association of Christmas tree growers.
There's a big concentration of foresters here just because there's a research institute and forestry faculty of University of Agriculture from Prague. And also there's a lot of foresters working for local forests and teachers from the university staying here. That's one of our advantages. We are part of the university city, like Prague. Of course, we are small, but anyway.
The university uses its premises here to give its students hands-on experience in the sprawling forests it owns in the environs, and also to provide them with a very special retreat. The campus, for lack of a better term, is not comprised of dormitories and instructional buildings, but is housed in a Gothic castle, reconstructed into a Renaissance chateau with elements of Baroque.
So the castle is the property of Czech University of Life Sciences since 1935. It serves for practical training of students coming from Czech University of Life Sciences, for example, silviculture, forest management, economy, and many others. There are more than 1,000 students coming every year to our university to do practical training in the castle as well as in our forests.
St. Adalbert, today one of the figures standing precipitously on the edge of Charles Bridge, was said to have founded a castellum, or small fort, here, with a watchtower to protect a thoroughfare to Prague from bandits sometime in the 14th century. With time, and a number of blue-blooded owners and Italian architects, the watchtower and embankment developed into the stunningly picturesque chateau that the university uses as a campus today. What immediately strikes the visitor after the beauty of the castle itself is the lack of entry fees, guides, and roped-off corridors. This is a living castle where people work, live, and study. Classes are in gaping medieval halls, offices boast 6-meter ceilings and enormous chandeliers made of antlers, and the walls, cellars, turrets, and attics conceal secrets upon secrets. Secret corridors are said to run throughout the castle, and escape routes are thought to have their exits concealed in the mine shafts in the surrounding woods. And there is, of course, no dearth of ghosts and buried treasure. Resident history buff Jiří Neuheffer.
The walls of the castle conceal not only history, but allegedly also the treasure of the Smiřický family. The treasure is said to be guarded by one of the Smiřický noblewomen, Kateřina Smiřická. During the reconstruction that was underway in 2001, a painting of a lady was discovered on a wall in a newly uncovered part of the castle. Her face, however, had been intentionally destroyed, and it's possible that a treasure hunter tried to upset the magical powers of the Black Lady, who guards the treasure, so that he might find it.
Of such a small town, one could be tempted to say, without the castle and the university, there wouldn't be much here. But that would not be true. There is also a brewery. Such a fascinating brewery, in fact, that the fact that they don't make any beer is almost beside the point. Milan Starets, the brewery's owner and refurbisher, on exactly what he has in mind.
V roce 1987 tady v areálu Kosteleckého pivovaru byla kompletně...
In 1987, the brewery completely terminated its beer production, and since then the building has just been falling apart, and all the original technology on the grounds was looted. So we're gradually reconstructing the whole building and doing the whole thing according to the original blueprints, and using the technology that was originally used. Since all of the technology is not in place anymore, we are replacing it with technology from other demolished breweries. The basic concept is for the Černokostelecký brewery to create on the one hand a beer museum and on the other a gastronomic center that includes, most importantly, a brewery.
V původních pivovarských prostorech a hlavně teda taky pivovar.
The brewery is currently a mix of debris and development, with yawning holes in the ground and strewn rubble, and lofty, perfectly remodeled brewing tank rooms and copper and marble bar counters. Walking back towards the town with its many old churches, decrepit early 90s shop signs, its glorious spired chateau and omnipresent peeling paint, one gets the feeling that the state of the brewery is a reflection of the state of the town itself, neglected but truly on its way somewhere. Mr. Michalik, who is originally from Silesia, in the east of the country, told me about what brought him to the fort above the Black Forests and what keeps him here.
I moved here some 20 years ago because I got a good job that time here. Just after revolution, I started to run my company here. So it's a nice city, big potential for whatever you like. Pretty peaceful and quiet, pretty nice people here. It's close to Prague, so once you are interested in the culture or being in touch with whatever is in Prague, so it's some 40-minute drive. As well, we are close to the nature, to the forest surrounding the city. So that's something which I was trying to find, and I did.
The peace and quiet in this place, devoid of any heavy industry or highway traffic, is palpable and actually smells a bit of sap and sawdust. If that is what you seek, the wild woods await you. And if not, the brewery is to open with a bash this summer.
That edition of Spotlight was first aired in March of 2009. And we'll wind up today's show with another of David Vaughan's popular miniseries from the archives.
In From the Archives this week, we carry on where we left off at the end of July in our chronological journey through the Czech radio archives. We'd reached the point just after the end of World War II. After the initial euphoria, the hard work of rebuilding the country began, not least at the Czechoslovak radio building itself, which had been shot to pieces in the Prague uprising and received a direct hit from a German aerial torpedo. Here is the radio director, Bohuslav Laštovička, in January 1947, solemnly reopening the radio's entrance hall.
Blahopřeji všem pracovníkům rozhlasu k úspěchu, kterého jsme společnou prací dosáhli.
Congratulations, he said, to all my radio colleagues for what we have achieved through our work together and for working to heal the wounds left by the German enemy. My thanks to all the workers, craftsmen and other colleagues who have helped to renovate our main entrance. Long live Czechoslovak Radio and our beloved Republic.
A naší milované republice zdar.
Another step on the road to normality was the re-election in June 1946, with the overwhelming support of Parliament, of Edvard Beneš as president. He had spent 6 years as president in exile in Britain, and in the months immediately after the war had ruled by decree. For the first time, radio broadcast the president's swearing-in ceremony live.
Slibuji na svou čest a svědomí, že budu dbát blaha republiky a lidu a šetřit ústavních a jiných zákonů.
Pane prezidente, republice a prezidentovi sláva!
Some places, like the villages of Lidice and Ležáky, which had been wiped off the map during the German occupation, could never return to normal. But even in Lidice, the widows of the nearly 200 men who had been murdered were gradually returning home. And the two pilots from the village who had served in Britain's Royal Air Force during the war also came back. One of them, Josef Horák, who had lost 17 members of his immediate family, brought with him his young English wife and their two children. They took part in a special Christmas broadcast on Christmas Eve, 1946.
We have a little community here. We all try to help each other.
Come over here, dear. We want you to say a few words into the microphone.
What is a microphone?
If you speak into it, people who are not in this room can hear you.
Merry Christmas to you, B.Y.Y.
Behind the illusion that Czechoslovakia was returning to normal, other things were happening that remind us that times were still turbulent. To this day, the expulsion of almost the entire German-speaking population of Czechoslovakia in the immediate aftermath of the war remains highly controversial. And there were also many signs that the country's democracy was far from secure. But more of that in the coming weeks.
David Vaughan's From the Archives, which Radio Prague is currently rerunning. You'll find the entire series at www.radio.cz, along with all of Radio Prague's programmes in text and sound. I'm afraid that's all we have for you today. Should you like to contact us, our email address is english@radio.cz. We'll be glad to hear from you. This is Daniela Lazarová saying thanks for joining us today and goodbye. Thank you.
vous écoutez Radio Prague.